Welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls to talk about the first formal day of the Brexit negotiations. So James, is today really going to be that exciting, or is it really just people having meetings about when they're next going to have meetings?
So today they're looking at the priorities for the negotiations, so EU citizens' rights in the UK and vice versa, the Irish border, and the timings. I don't think there's going to be any great big bust-up today. Indeed, I think one of the telling things is that leading up to the general election, the UK government kept talking as if there was going to be a big row over timing, basically saying if the EU won't discuss the future trade relationship, we're not going to engage on anything else. We're not going to discuss the amount of money that the EU wants or anything like that. The UK government's position on that has radically softened in the days since the election. It is now quite clear that they are happy to discuss this other stuff before you get on to the future trade relationship. I think the other big thing that has shifted is this question of the length of the transition. Theresa May never denied that there was going to be a transition period, but she didn't really want to shout about it from the rooftops. You know, as one very senior member of the government said to me, we can now be more candid about that. I think the other thing that has changed is, and I think one of the reasons Theresa May went for an early election was she thought that a three-year transition period, 2 years of negotiation, it'd all be done and dusted by the general election in 2022. I think there is now a sense that this might take longer than that. And I think that the compromise that is emerging within the Tory party is that you will get to the place that the Brexiteers want in terms of leaving both the single market and the customs union, but you will get there at a pace that will please Philip Hammond and Amber Rudd and the more Remain elements of the Tory party more, because it will not be as quick as they would have liked. The Brexiteers would have liked.
So, Katie, if we're expecting compromises during these negotiations that we probably hadn't been anticipating a few months ago, one of the things about the Conservative Party is it's not particularly good at accepting compromises on Europe, on both sides, actually, in terms of the Brexiteers and the Remainers. What's the mood in the party at the moment?
Well, I think lots of the Brexit-backing MPs now feel that, in a way, they have more of a mandate than ever for Brexit. One MP said, the thing is, if we don't make a success of Brexit now, we as a party are finished. They feel they've lost ground in so many other places that Brexit is even more important. I also think that lots of the more hard-line Brexiteers, there's no one really, there's no other party they can go to for help on having a harder Brexit. So in a way, they're going to have to, you know, like it or lump it on lots of the decisions Theresa May makes. She is their best bet at the moment for a harder Brexit. As for the Remain MPs, I think they can have a lot more fun, or mischief anyway. Yeah, they can flirt with amendments from Labour in the Queen's speech. They can suggest to Tory whips that they might rebel unless the Tories compromise. And they feel emboldened by the election result. In a sense that they didn't before, they feel that there is now scope for a softer Brexit.
That's pretty high risk, isn't it? Because that could also bring down the government.
Yeah, and I think what the whips are relying on is the fact that if you go too far, you could have Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister. But I think that with people like Anna Soubry, they're people who they can be unpredictable. So I think they've got to really relay this point. But I think even just pointing out that you might end up with Labour government, given how strongly some Remain MPs feel, like you can't see someone like Ken Clark ever backing the Tories on this. And this is one vote already gone. I mean, you don't even have a majority.
James, I would ask you what Labour's overall position on Brexit is, but that would just be too mean. But what can we expect from various parts of the Labour front bench when it comes to the Queen's speech and Brexit?
Well, I think Labour can play classic opposition politics with Brexit. They don't actually need to be unified to vote against everything. You can say that Labour's position of basically wanting all the benefits of a single market, but without any of the responsibilities when it comes to the four freedoms, including freedom of movement, is crazy. But actually, as an opposition, you can say, that's what the government should negotiate, and we'll vote down any deal. And I think that is how you can see that Corbyn will hold his party together on this Brexit question, which is, you know, it doesn't matter what he or John McDonnell personally think. They can turn around and say, Theresa May's not got this impossibly good deal that we wanted her to get, therefore we will oppose it. And so I think that's how Labour hold the line on this.
One of the odd things about the context in which these negotiations are starting in is that we do have a government, but not a very confident one, that it can actually get its business through the House of Commons at the moment, James. How is the government actually able to do these Brexit negotiations when it's still negotiating with the DUP about being able to legislate in Parliament?
Well, there is a kind of paradox here, which is you could make a slightly Panglossian argument, which is in Europe, they wanted Theresa May to win big because they thought that would create more certainty for these talks. And they also thought that it would make it easier for them to say, look, you've got to be prepared to compromise because we know that you can afford to lose a few of your more hardline MPs. Now she can't afford to lose any of her hardline MPs. But as Katie said, the problem for her is she's got hardline MPs on both sides of a question. So I think it is tricky to see how it happens. I think one direct material effect that the DUP thing has is the DUP, there's not been lots of inaccurate coverage on this. The DUP don't want any softer Brexit than the Tory mainstream. But the difference is this, the DUP do not want to walk away without a deal. Because nearly all the negative consequences of no deal are most concentrated in Northern Ireland because of the border question. So I think you won't hear Theresa May saying, I'm, you know, at times, Theresa May has sounded and David Davis have sounded like they're itching to walk away, to basically get up, kick the table over, do what David Cameron never did, say, we're off, you come back to us with a better offer. I don't think you're going to see that happen now because the DUP element of the government's voting majority in the Commons couldn't accept that.
And just on the question of Northern Ireland and Brexit, politicians at the top of the Conservative Party have been saying for months that they're determined to get a solution to the border between Northern Ireland and Ireland. Have we got any sense of whether they've got any idea of what they're going to ask for now?
I think there is a contradiction on both sides in their approach to the Irish border, because the EU say, oh, we don't want to discuss a future trading relationship, we want to settle these three questions, including the border question first. How can you settle the border question until you know what the trading relationship is between the UK and the EU? The nature of that border is very different if there is a customs arrangement, not a customs union, a customs arrangement between the UK and the EU, than if there isn't. So I don't see how you settle, and this is something that very senior figures in the Brexit department have been genuinely puzzled about. They're like, I don't understand how we can work out how we're going to handle the border until we know what the relationship is, you know. And I think there are ways. This is the great tragedy of the Irish question, which is there are clear ways and precedents for dealing with this. We have Norway and Sweden, France and Switzerland, of land borders between countries that are inside and outside the customs union. That would require essentially allowing a kind of 15-mile strip on either side where the jurisdiction of the other state would run. The big question is, given the history, can you have people with the crown on their shoulders stopping vehicles inside the Irish Republic? And equally, could unionists in Northern Ireland live with members of a Garda stopping vehicles on British sovereign soil and searching them, etc.?
And Katie, aside from the battles over Brexit in the Queen's speech, are we expecting anything particularly radical on domestic policy?
Yeah, I think probably the problem they're having right now is basically how to fill it, because a lot of what was in the very unpopular Tory manifesto is going to be in the bin. We think Brexit will make up a big chunk of it. Anti-terrorism measures is something that they can get votes on, so that would be in it. We had in your blog, we had domestic violence is something she can focus on. And I think there's also a question about how they phrase Brexit, because in the Tory manifesto they're very explicit. They said we're leaving the single market, we're leaving the customs union. They may want to fudge that slightly and just put in parts of the Lancaster House speech, which might be a way of getting the more erstwhile Remain MPs to back it, unless the threat of Corbyn is enough. But yeah, I think a lot of it is going to just highlight the fact this is a government that probably won't achieve that much, even though it's a 2-year session.
And finally, this is going to be the last Queen's speech for 2 years, because Theresa May has cancelled the 2018 Queen's speech before she's even managed to sign off the one that's due this week. James, why has she done that? Is that just a nakedly political calculation to keep her in her job, or is it actually quite necessary given the Brexit negotiations?
The charitable interpretation is that the Great Repeal Bill is a massive piece of legislation. I mean, it is bigger than anything else I can think of in terms of bills in recent parliamentary history. And it will take a lot of time. The less charitable explanation is the Tories are having enough trouble working out what to put in this Queen's speech and how to get that through, and they've no desire to do that again. I think there is also a view of, in certain sections of the Tory party, that you almost should divide up this Parliament into two bits, which is one is the bit to 2019 and the end of the Brexit talks, which some people think that is the kind of May premiership. And then after that, when the Tories will get a new leader and spend 3 years trying to come up with something a bit more crowd-pleasing, a bit more upbeat, that they can then go to the country with. So I think you see a mixture of things at work here. I mean, I don't think it's quite I think you could make a case for it, even if the Tories had won a majority of what everyone thought they would win, kind of 60-odd, for this idea of a two-year session. But I think it has particular appeal in the current circumstances.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Katie. And you can subscribe to this podcast on the iTunes store. It's called Coffee House Shots. And we have a special offer for podcast listeners, 12 issues for £12 and a limited edition moleskin notebook. Just go to spectator.co.uk/pod offer.